from the Missouri School of Journalism. Welcome to Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. When South Sudan became a country in 2011, there was a lot of optimism in a nation where people had endured decades of conflict to win independence from Sudan. But within 3 years, the country had descended into its own civil war, a war that continues to this day. Today, more than a third of South Sudan's population has been forced from their homes. More than half the population is expected to need humanitarian aid this year, as fighting has kept farmers from harvesting their crops. Children are used as soldiers, and mass rape as a weapon of war. Elections have been scheduled for next month, though few think they will take place. Many of you may remember that the United States played a major role in helping South Sudan gain independence. It long showered aid and weapons on the Sudan People's Liberation Army, which became South Sudan's ruling party under President Salva Kiir. But the Trump administration has signaled a major shift in U.S. policy in South Sudan, and its U.N. Ambassador Nikki Haley recently referred to South Sudan's government as, quote, an unfit partner for peace, and has called for an arms embargo on the country. That's much to the dismay of Kiir's government. On this edition of Global Journalist, I'll look at the spiraling conflict in South Sudan and what the U.S. and other outsiders might do to help. For a look at this, we're joined by three people who have been following the conflict closely. Joining us from Nairobi, Kenya, is Eder Peralta. He's the East Africa correspondent for NPR. Eder, welcome.
Glad to be here, Jason.
Joining us from New York, we have Jehani Henry. She's a team leader in the Africa Division of Human Rights Watch. Jehani, welcome to Global Journalist.
Hi, thanks.
And with us from Washington, D.C. is James Buddy. He's the managing editor and host of Daybreak Africa, the breakfast news show on Voice of America that airs all across the African continent. James, it's a pleasure.
Thank you for the invitation.
Well, let me start with you, Eder Peralta. Just remind us about how this conflict got started in South Sudan. South Sudan fought a horrible war for decades to get independence, as we mentioned. But then in late 2013, the president, Salva Kiir, had a falling out with his vice president. Tell us, you know, briefly what's happened since.
Yeah, I mean, this was a sort of, you know, great story on the continent. It ended the longest running war on the continent. And yeah, and as you said, in 2013, Salva Kiir had a falling out with Riek Machar, who was his vice president. He accused him of plotting a coup. And since then, the country has been embroiled in a civil war. You know, there was a small detent in 2016, but that very quickly again started, the war very quickly started up again when Riek Machar was forced to leave South Sudan. And ever since, the international community has been trying to get these two parties to come and talk and sort of put these differences aside. But the conflict has actually just become a lot more complex since then. And as you said, there's been a huge amount of displacement. And, you know, the war is ongoing till this day. And it doesn't look like any of the efforts to get a peace agreement seem to be working.
And Eder, remind us, there is an ethnic dimension to this conflict.
There is, you know, there you've got the Dinkas and the Nuers, which are kind of the two big sides in this. The Dinka are part of the ruling party, but as I said, it's gotten a lot more complex recently. Paul Malong, who was a former general in the government, also a Dinka, split from the government. So I think, you know, a conflict that I feel like we understood in terms of these two sides is very complex. And there's also an incredible amount of intercommunal violence that has nothing to do with the politics of Juba that sort of drives this conflict in the rural areas of South Sudan. So yes, there is an ethnic part to this, but there's also a much more complex part to this that's actually much harder to fix.
Well, Jehani Henry, if I could bring you into this conflict has been marked by some horrible attacks on civilians. Your group says there is evidence of war crimes committed by both sides, by different rebel groups, militias, the government. What types of atrocities have you been documenting?
Yes, that's absolutely right. Since the very beginning of the conflict, as it unfolded, it started in Juba. This is December 2013. The first hours and days were very much concentrated in Juba, where you had the army basically factioning into two, and you had largely Dinka soldiers, pro-government, and then you had a lot of newer soldiers who were defecting. And that's when it started to take on this ethnic component. And during those first hours and days in Juba, there were massacres, including one that we investigated in a police compound that has never been properly analyzed, in which close to 300 people were killed. And there are other sites as well in Juba. The conflict then spread. It spread north, and it has ravaged South Sudan's main towns. Some towns like Malakal, close to the Sudanese border, have changed hands four or five or more times by now. Almost all the people are now living in protection of civilian sites on UN compounds or in IDP camps, or have fled the country and become refugees. So in terms of the violations, I mean, you have more than just war crimes, which are crimes committed in the context of a conflict and governed by international humanitarian law, but you also have crimes against humanity most likely committed in South Sudan, which is another category and involves sometimes it involves killing, sometimes it can involve rape, and it has occurred in pockets, and it has occurred during different periods. So when looking at South Sudan, as Eder said, it is a complex conflict. It's now over 5 years running, we are continuing to see it sort of bubbling up in different locations, maybe in slightly different ways. So as certain things change, the crimes also change. So for example, we've seen quite a lot of disappearances and targeted killings in areas where the government is cracking down on opposition and taking out and attacking a lot of the civilians, often based on their ethnicity, who are associated with the rebels. But then in other stages of the conflict, we've had open fighting between two fighting forces. And so the dynamics can be a little different depending on what's going on. So I could go on and on about this. But yes, well, I mean, the list of crimes is...
Well, I'll come back to this because I think there are a few additional points that we want to raise. But let me turn this to James Buddy then, because President Kiir had said that South Sudan would hold elections next month. That's just, about 28, 30 days from now. This is in the midst of a civil war. Tell us why he's trying to do this and what the likelihood is that there can be sort of a successful, credible election.
Well, I think President Salva Kiir is mentioned having this election, particularly I think it was the Minister of Information, Michael McQuay, who suggested or threatened the opposition that the government will consider having election because the government feels that the rebels led by Riek Machar have not been very sincere and genuine during the negotiation process. So they have threatened to have this election. But everyone you talk to in South Sudan know very well. They say to you that having election, they don't see how that is going to be possible for a number of reasons. First of all, some of the parties who the opposition groups say that will be an illegal election. It will be in violation of the current peace process that is being mediated by the Intergovernmental Development Authority, the IGA, that would be in violation.
This is the
of
grouping of East African nations that includes Uganda, Kenya, Ethiopia, Sudan.
Exactly. Then also, what do you do about the 2 million or so more South Sudan citizens who are in refugee camps or internally displaced? What do you do about them? You need to have those people back into the country in order to have a credible election. Then also, does the government have the funds? So who benefits to have this election? It would mean that perpetuating the current leadership in power. So hopefully, maybe the revitalization process that is underway, as you know, that IGA has given the two leaders, Riek Machar and President Salva Kiir, until June 30th to meet, that they should meet by June 30th.
This is Global Journalist. On today's program, we're talking about the political standoff in South Sudan, a country that has been mired in civil war for most of its brief history. We're joined by Eder Peralta, the East Africa correspondent for NPR, Jehani Henry of the Africa Division of Human Rights Watch, and James Buddy, the host of Daybreak Africa on The Voice of America. Well, Eder Peralta, as James had been mentioning, there have been these on-again, off-again peace talks between President Kiir's government and Machar's opposition that has been mediated by IGAD, by the group of East African nations. Is there any reason for optimism, given this June 30th deadline, that there can be some sort of form of ceasefire, if not a more durable peace?
Yeah, I mean, we can sort of get into like the nuts and bolts of this agreement, right, which is really complex. I mean, they're talking about a power sharing formula. But just to give you an idea.
But correct me if I'm wrong. This is something that had been tried before. Machar had been Kiir's vice president.
Right. I mean, there was an agreement in 2016 that was supposed to sort of create a power sharing agreement, but it fell apart months into it. But what gives you an idea of how tough this is right now is IGAD, which is the East African states, have said, okay, let's bring in the opposition here. But there's one huge problem: that Riek Machar, the former first vice president of South Sudan, has not even been invited into the talks, right? So you're at this very basic level in these talks where they're trying to decide, how do we get this guy who is in exile in South Africa into these talks? So, you know, you can talk all you want about what this transitional government would look like, but there's very basic things that have not yet been agreed to. And not only that, but the conflict since, you know, the 2016 peace agreement has just gotten more complex. There, the number of opposition forces, shall we say, opposition rebels, has just grown immensely. So you have to take that into account. You first have to sort of fix these basic things, and then you have to bring in all these other groups. So there doesn't seem to be much hope on the horizon. I think the only hope I'm hearing is that it seems that the international community has stepped up some of the pressure. The United States says that it is reviewing all of its funding. And, you know, the UN is now considering sanctions against certain South Sudanese leaders. And I've heard from analysts who believe that maybe this could move these talks forward, that the pressure from the international community could move these talks forward. Another thing is here in Kenya. Kenya, you know, it's the big player in the region, and they have had their own political problems here. But they are now all of a sudden focused again on the region, and they have sent representatives, high-level representatives, to these talks in an effort to get them going.
Well, John Henry, let me ask you about some of the other international players in this conflict then. As Eder mentioned, these other East African countries have been trying to mediate this conflict. Kenya, Uganda, Ethiopia, these are countries that have also taken in hundreds of thousands of refugees. What are their stakes in this conflict? Don't they have their own sort of interests at heart as well?
Certainly, yes, they do. I think among the neighboring states, we also can't leave out Sudan. Sudan probably has a very large number of Southerners or South Sudanese, but historically it always had as well. So before South Sudan became independent, many Southerners during that long-running Sudanese civil war lived in the north. Sudan feels it has a special role in this conflict and wants to show the world that it can resolve the conflict, not in small part because it is now trying to make good with the United States and had its own economic sanctions lifted recently. And so don't forget about Sudan as a key player. As others mentioned, of course, Kenya, Uganda, and Ethiopia are also neighboring countries and have their own interests. There's always been shifting alliances. You know, one day you'll say, oh, well, Kenya favors the opposition and Uganda favors the government. And then the next year or two or three years down the line, you might hear the opposite. So I'd say that this is part of the landscape in this region. But what it does mean is that in terms of imposing sanctions on individual commanders, and we've recommended many, and as was mentioned, the UN has threatened new ones to be imposed within the next 30 days if the parties don't get their act together and the abuses don't stop. But in terms of making those sanctions effective, you need the neighboring countries, because the neighboring countries have the banks. They have the banks and they have the properties that these individuals supposedly own. Many South Sudanese leaders own properties, multiple properties in neighboring countries. So their cooperation is important. The United States has been very keen on implementing sanctions and is talking to the regional actors about that. So let's see if you know, if some attention can be drawn to that, to those gaps. But until now, they really are gaps. In other words, the UN imposes sanctions, but the region doesn't implement them, and so they don't mean anything. That is sort of the conundrum.
Well, let's pick up on that, if you would, James Buddy. I saw that VOA had interviewed recently a senior UN official who called for the leaders of this conflict to be sanctioned. Presumably, he was talking about President Kiir and Riek Machar themselves. Is there some sense that in spite of whatever outside mediators do, that these two men may not actually want peace? I mean, we're talking about a war entering its fifth year.
I see. On the issue of sanctions, the South Sudan government, I don't know, it tries to threaten the international community by suggesting that each time the sanctions are brought up, it will say that sanctions are not in the interest of reaching any peace deal with anybody. So I think the pressure that is being applied right now maybe is the right way to go. We have to wait to see what's coming up. Now, coming into the picture is Raila Odinga, the opposition leader from Kenya. Both the both President Salva Kiir and Riek Machar said they welcome Raila Odinga coming into the picture. I think now he's either doing that on behalf of the African Union. So he's going to play some role in this latest peace talks that are coming up. As my colleague just said, the whole peace process is complicated. First of all, the government, the whole issue of governance, who is going to be in the government, what should be done with the military. The government of South Sudan does not accept what the rebels are putting forward. So it's too much complication as they go into the latest round of the peace process.
Well, James, if we could as well, I mean, this conflict, it does sound like it is one of the sort of larger, more violent conflicts in the world right now. And I know that your network does a lot of reporting on this, but generally speaking, in the international media, you just don't hear a lot about the war in South Sudan. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think we do our best, and we do have a South Sudan, as a program specifically that goes to South Sudan. And I do read that they cover it. Some international news organs cover what's going on in South Sudan. Of course, you may be right that when people do not see too much fighting or see the images of refugees, maybe they think that nothing is happening. But there's a whole lot happening in South Sudan every day.
A reminder that you're tuned into Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. On today's program, we're talking about the civil war in South Sudan, already one of the poorest countries on earth, and a place where more than a third of the population has been forced from their homes by fighting. We're joined by Eder Peralta, the East Africa correspondent for NPR News, Jehani Henry of the Africa Division of Human Rights Watch, and James Buddy, the managing editor and host of Daybreak Africa on The Voice of America. If you're interested in more Global Journalists, check us out online at globaljournalist.org. There you can find our archives and additional coverage of underreported international news and human rights issues. You can also like us on Facebook, where we live stream, follow us on Twitter, subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, or see our videocast on YouTube. Eder Peralta, if I could just pick up on this point about sort of telling the story of what's happening in South Sudan. I understand that you were there last year and were arrested and detained for several days by the South Sudanese authorities. Tell us what happened to you.
So, I mean, I think it speaks to part of the the issue with South Sudan, part of the issue of telling the story in South Sudan, is that there is a pretty significant press corps here in Nairobi, international press corps here in Nairobi. And, you know, I would venture to say that most of us have been banned from the country. You know, South Sudan, during the war with Sudan, the rebels were very welcoming of the press. They took power and things went south for them. They started pushing journalists out. And so it's very hard to get accreditation to report in the country. I ended up going in on a business visa to ask for accreditation. And when I was asking for accreditation, the National Security Service arrested me and threw me into Blue House, which is the national security prison. I should note that some very brave journalists who have gone in with the rebels through the Uganda side, one very young American journalist was shot in the head. So the covering this conflict is very difficult, specifically because there's very little access to it. I mean, when you think about it, we don't know how many people have died during this conflict because no one is keeping a good count of it. Jehani could probably speak a little more about this. But that's one of the problems of covering South Sudan, that the government doesn't want you to cover it. But also, there's huge limitations in this country. There's not a good road network where you can sort of get to places very easily. So you have to jump on small planes, and so you need the permission of the government to move around freely as you would like. And that's been very difficult to do. So we have insight into this conflict many times through the borders, through the refugees, but we don't have a lot of insight into the actual fighting and into the atrocities, quite honestly. You know, the human rights groups, Human Rights Watch has done great work down there to try and bring some of these things to light, but there's not enough of it for the size of this conflict. I mean, you're looking at more than a million people having fled to Uganda right now. So the size of this is pretty staggering, but the visibility of it is very low.
Well, Jehani, I'll give you a chance to weigh in on that as well, because, you know, Ader had been talking about the difficulties for journalists. Correct me if I'm wrong. I think 6 or 7 journalists have been killed in South Sudan over the last couple of years. But there's also an issue of aid distribution. When you're talking about half the country being in need of aid, aid workers have also come under attack. I think something like 100 have been killed since the civil war began. What can you tell us about how aid is getting distributed?
Yes, I mean, it's true that the space for civil society, including for humanitarian actors, has shrunk. And we have seen attacks basically perpetrated on both sides against aid workers, detentions of aid workers, a lot of suspicion around them, especially those who try to go to opposition areas from Juba. It's hard to get permission, and then there's a lot of suspicion. And yes, it's a dangerous, dangerous context. In terms of aid delivery, I mean, South Sudan is extremely aid reliant. The people living in the POC sites and in IDP camps across the country are often relying entirely on food aid because they can't cultivate their land. So the amount of aid that's needed, that's going in, is enormous. And obviously, you know, the fact that people, that aid groups are having a hard time reaching some of these areas for political reasons, let alone the logistics and the rainy season and whatnot, it just complicates, it makes the situation even more dire. It is a very serious aggravating factor. The party should know that attacks on aid groups are in themselves serious crimes, which could even be the basis for sanctions. They don't take it seriously enough. There's a lot of bullying and manipulation of aid, and that has always been the case in this conflict in South Sudan.
Well, Jehani, if I could just pin you down quickly. Now, you've talked about a number of different groups and entities committing human rights violations, committing atrocities there. Is there one group in particular that has the most blood on its hands?
Definitely the government side. There's no doubt in my mind, and that's not just because of the work I did sort of in the last three missions, but really all the way through. You know, there have been, the government is extremely defensive, paranoid. It has hardened. It has become increasingly paranoid and hard and very heavy-handed. So the counterinsurgencies that it has waged across the Equatorias, trying to root out these ever more factioning rebels, have consisted of attacking the civilians themselves, basically saying, you are protecting rebels, therefore you are a rebel. And that is why more than a million people poured into Uganda so quickly and now live as refugees there. The government's tactics have been very brutal. But as I mentioned earlier, the dynamics of the fighting are different in different locations. So in cases where you have the two sides on, you know, at the front lines actually engaged in battle, fighting one another, you know, you're seeing both of them being indiscriminate. You're seeing both of them committing crimes against civilians in their midst. And we've also had opposition or rebel fighters, for example, abduct aid workers and been responsible for killings and rapes and pretty much the whole gamut. But I would say that most of what we've seen over the course of the conflict has gone back to the government and its commanders. And the fact that the SPLA does have a command control system makes it possible for us to identify commanders who are responsible.
Well, Jehan, we're running short on time, but let me just turn this to James Budde then. Is this why we see that there has been this shift in the United States policy? And the U.S. seems to be moving away from its former ally, the South Sudanese government. How significant is that? Is that some reason for optimism?
Well, you know that United States played an important role in making possible the independence of South Sudan. But I think as my colleagues have said, almost every other country has gotten just frustrated with what's happening. And so now the maximum pressure is being applied, including the United States, on the South Sudan government and also the rebels to make sure that finally maybe the, a peace process is achieved in this latest round of talks. Let me say that those of all who have covered the war, we know that covering war is the most difficult assignment people have, journalists have. When we bring up these issues with the South Sudan government and even the rebels, the blame is always that the South Sudan government will say, oh, these journalists did not ask permission to go to this direction or to go to this area. The same thing with the distribution of relief aid. We say, no, you cannot do this. And the government will say, well, we at the government, they did not tell us before going in that area, because there's a war going on. So it's a very difficult thing to cover war, and so all we have to do is to continue to do our best, and that's what everybody is doing. That's what we are doing also at the Voice of America.
Well, we're out of time for this edition of Global Journalist, a production of the Reynolds Journalism Institute at the Missouri School of Journalism and KBIA, Mid-Missouri Public Radio. Many thanks to Ada Peralta, Jehani Henry, and James Budde. Our producers this week are Edom Kasae and Rosie Belson. Aaron Hay is audio engineer and Travis McMillan is director. For all of us at Global Journalist, I'm Jason McClure. Thanks for tuning in.